Thanks, Carrie. My name's Erin. I don't think I introduced myself before when I did the finance announcement, but if I haven't met you already and you're visiting today, please introduce yourself after if you'd like. Good to meet you. I'm lead pastor here at Artisan. And actually, thank you to Carrie. More than reading scripture, Carrie actually led our community in a dialogue on Thursday night, which was quite, I don't know what the word is for it. It was lovely. It was amazing. To me, it felt like a real placemaking conversation where we actually were sitting here in a full circle, about 70 of us, and we were having a conversation about how to have difficult conversations. So like, what are the skills we need in order to engage with each other across difference? And how do we do that well? What are times when we don't do that well? And what is it that leads to that? And there's lots more to come out of that conversation, but I just wanted, for those who weren't there, to let you know that that happened and was, I think, a really important conversation starter for our community. So this week, we're beginning the final portion of our series on place. It's a 3-month series on place, actually. And for the next few weeks, we're moving from the being uprooted, because we followed the scriptural arc of starting with rooted in creation, being uprooted, and moving to being rerouted. And I'm going to step away from this because I have one of these. Okay, I keep forgetting. It's a bit of a diva mic, right? I'm not used to it yet. Okay, and in this week, we're moving into this the third phase of the series, which is what placemaking looks like when we're en route to new creation. So we can't be rooted in the way we were in creation. We experience dislocation, a sense of a loss of place. But what do we do? How do we placemake in the meantime as we're en route? And part of the answer we said at the very beginning of the series is coming back to our history and our stories. And if we're reading the Bible with this lens of place in mind, we see from Genesis to Revelation this sort of repeated pattern of people constantly wrestling with displacement, losing their place, finding a place again, losing their place, looking for a place, finding a place again. And when you return to the stories of displacement in Scripture, places where God's people are displaced, you'll start to notice how God turns exile into sojourning. God turns wandering aimlessly into purposeful sojourning, and does that by dwelling with God's people. So today we're going to come back to Jeremiah 29, this really well-known passage about the importance of God's people contributing to the good of the city. I just have to say that Jeremiah is a terribly long and complex book, and it feels a little bit wrong to be pulling this little section out of it. So I'm just going to acknowledge that if anybody was already feeling that way. If we were doing a whole series on Jeremiah, we could get into a lot more context and we'd probably get into a lot more thorny things. But we're going to work just with this passage in part because it's a passage that gets used a lot by churches to bring up this question of how we engage with broader culture and how we turn our gaze outward as a community. So it seemed like an important passage to touch down on. And maybe I'll just give a bit of context from Jeremiah and acknowledge there's so much more. Somebody who lives next to me is an Old Testament scholar or the Hebrew scripture scholar who teaches at UBC, and he has a massive garden on the corner. And so I was driving home yesterday from finishing preparing, and I parked and I grabbed him and I was like, some of you will know who he is. I just said, hey, I'm preaching on Jeremiah, and it's like, I can't believe I'm preaching on gardening and baking and homemaking when I never do that stuff very well. And he put me at ease, and he says, like, just remember that's not what this passage is about. And I said, I know, I just got to get over this. So what is this passage about? Okay, so Jeremiah is written at a point when ancient Israel is in exile. They were conquered by the Babylonians and the Assyrians, and a lot of their people have been relocated to a different city, some in forced labor, some not. And they're now in a place that's surrounded by people they could call enemies. The first half of Jeremiah that we haven't read names with really intense emotion this violence, this trauma, this loss, catastrophe, right? And it does it with really strong language, breaking down what this was. It's a complete destruction happening to his people and their way of life. And it's the kind of communal trauma that can produce old anger, right? And old rage that just sits in you for generations and explodes and spatters on people at the strangest of times, and you have no idea where it came from. This is the kind of catastrophe that they've undergone as a community. And given what they've experienced, they're naturally angry and grieving, saying, when will we get to go back? What's the point of life in the meantime? Why did this happen? And this is the perfect time for a prophet to enter the scenes. I have probably far too idealized a picture of what prophets are, but helping us to reimagine the world and our circumstance in light of a bigger reality. So Jeremiah the prophet lived while this was happening, this displacement. But if you look at the first three verses of Jeremiah, you'll see that the book itself was written after all the dust has been settled. So there's a distinction between Jeremiah and what he said in the moment, and then this book, which is written as a way of helping the people who are now scattered in exile to reinterpret what happened to them, right? And in chapter 27, just a couple chapters before what we read, Jeremiah has put this large wooden yoke around his neck as a symbol of exile, and sends a message to the king saying, this is not gonna be over soon. Like, you're gonna have to accept this yoke. This is yours. We're staying here for a while. And then in chapter 28, we hear that there are some people who are coming along, like Hananiah, who are saying, don't worry, we'll be going back soon. We are surrounded by our enemies, but just hold on, we're gonna return. And Jeremiah here in 29 says, and at the end of 28 says, no, that's not what's happening here. So he writes this letter. So let me just read it again. From Jerusalem, he writes to the elders, the priests, the prophets, and all the people who had been exiled to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says to all the captives he has exiled to Babylon from Jerusalem. Build homes and plan to stay. Plant gardens and eat the food they produce. Marry and have children. Then find spouses for them so that you may have many grandchildren. They're going to be here a long time, for generations. Multiply. Do not dwindle away. And work for the peace and prosperity of the city where I sent you into exile. Pray to the Lord for that place, for its welfare will determine your welfare. In other words, you might feel like you can't flourish because you've been uprooted and are among those you could call enemies. But your flourishing is tied up with the place where you are, not where you want to be. You don't need to be on land that you call your own in order to love it. And that's a good word for a lot of us who live in Vancouver. You can put down roots here. You can put down roots now. You were made to be placed, to care for a place, to be cared for by a place. And that can happen here, even in displacement, even in this violent exile. And that's because God's here helping you to flourish. God's presence isn't only tied to one place or the life that you wish you could lead. Let's reimagine this exile as sojourning. Do you remember at the beginning of this series, we talked about sojourning as a concept and a practice, I suppose? To sojourn is to find a temporary resting place while you're on a journey. When you sojourn, you stop, you find a place of safety, and that place of safety and belonging helps you to remember the meaningfulness of your journey. So the journey is neither a dweller staying in one place all the time, nor a nomad who moves at will. Brian Walsh describes a sojourner as a homemaker, but a homemaker who is potentially on the move. And then God's dwelling presence is what makes our wandering purposeful, provides the sustenance and the place to find rest. God makes a place for us wherever we go. Okay, so as he writes this, Jeremiah isn't denying the reality of this violence of exile, right? In the preceding chapters, he's acknowledged it, in fact, in ways that are very uncomfortable. It's like he's saying that, yeah, this unspeakably terrible thing has been done to us, and I'm going to write it down with the strongest of language and in ways that will make the readers really uncomfortable to hear this. And I'm going to actually give you some reasoning that's going to make you uncomfortable, like around God's will for you, et cetera, et cetera. So you've lost your place, but you are here now. You've lost your place, maybe your sense of self, your people, your belonging, your sense of purpose, hope. And as you lament and rage about that, notice what that might be doing to you, pulling you out of shape and disconnecting you from the place that you are. Don't forget what's right in front of you. Don't pine for a different place. Don't ghost your present life, hoping for a different life. Live the life you've got. Does anybody know that song? I don't know, is that from the 60s and 70s? You gotta love the one you're with. I don't know if I like the rest of the song, but you can look that one up. But you gotta love the one you're with. I feel like it's a bit like you gotta love the life you've got, right? You gotta love the place you are. Live as sojourners, not as exiles. I think this passage is about a very particular time in history, so I don't want to universalize it, but I feel like there might be a model here for us in our placemaking en route to new creation. And when I read this passage thinking about that, like what might this model look like, I notice two things. First, that it's not this spiritualized hope for a future place that we're putting off for the time being. And that really changes how we engage place now. It's about ordinary life here and now, what's right in front of us to do. In other words, build shelters, because you need those to survive. Grow food, because you're going to need that to survive. Create community. Take care of your survival as if you were going to be here for a long time. But do these ordinary things with intention. Do them intentionally. So what's the intentionality? And I think this is where the second part of his letter comes in. This placemaking is not about people taking good care of their own. Instead, the placemaking that Jeremiah describes is about contributing to the public good or the common good. So the call to a place is actually, in a sense, a call to humility. Like, be part of it. Join in. And this is something that we've repeated throughout the series. And we see again here. Contribute to the flourishing of the place as a whole. Take your part in it. And I love that these two things are held together, especially as someone who's not good at the gardening, the homemaking, that bit. That these two things actually come together and need to be held together in tension, right? Ordinary life and the vision for a common or public good. The ordinary homemaking, placemaking, food making, kin keeping, nurture, that's part of the same agenda as the community that is for the common and public good. And the call to be engaged in public life is part of the same agenda as homemaking and kinkeeping. I don't know if that feels profound to you, but to me that does. It feels like, you know, we might, at times in our lives, we might feel like all we can do is the survival bit, right? And there might be this question of, is this enough? Am I doing enough? We can do that in ways that contribute to the common good as well. You gotta love the one you're with. Live the life you've got. Love the place that you are. Live the life you've got. In our first sermon in this series, Tim and I had noticed the difference between sojourners and nomads. So I just want to return to that really quickly, just to kind of drive home this potential model for us in thinking about how we live en route to new creation. Sojourners put down roots where they are, even when they know they won't stay. And they do that because they journey with a sojourning God. So we don't want to yearn nostalgically for a better future or a better past or a different place. We want to settle in such a way that we don't grasp for ownership, but we become part of the community of creation. I want to get concrete, though, and I've asked a few people in our community to think concretely with me, and I'm going to invite them up in just a second. The three elements that I've asked each of them to speak to, these three sort of very practical, concrete practices, come from a book called No Place Like Home. No Home Like Place is actually what it's called. No Home Like Place. And he ends this book, which is trying to create a theology of place, with a chapter on gardens, baking, and hospitality. He says these are three of the most spiritual practices that we can muster. And he says it's because these practices slow us down, help us to locate ourselves, and open space for others. So done intentionally, these kind of three examples of very ordinary activities can help us to slow down, locate ourselves, open space for others in a way that contributes to the common good. So I've invited, is it Aubin that's coming first? Is Aubin here still? Aubin's here. Aubin and then Corey and then Crystal are gonna share.
Hello, I'm Aubin. Hi. So my family and I, we moved to the city about 12 years ago, and we are renters, as I'm sure many of you are as well. And since we've been living here in the city, we've had to move quite a lot. And so this idea of placemaking has been kind of a hard one for me, because the idea of home and homemaking is such an important value of mine, and I enjoy that very much. But even though we've had to move quite a bit, we've still tried to be very intentional with establishing ourselves in our neighborhood and on our street, wherever we are, making it a home, making it a place that, is significant for us, getting to know our neighbors. And I feel like in the city, especially if you're moving a lot, if you're renting, or even if you're not, maybe, I feel like it can be so easy for people to live a very insular, kind of independent life and just do everything on their own. And sometimes that does feel a bit easier, but we've always wanted to live more connected to the people around us. That's been important to us, and we've tried to do that in some very ordinary ways, like Aaron is talking about. So just some of the ways that we've done that are things like moving our picnic table from our backyard to our front yard so that we have a place for neighbors to linger and sit and chat. Currently, it's like the place to be for the kids in the neighborhood, which is pretty fun. Planting a garden has been a really important thing for me, not only because I love it, but because it's brought so much connection with our neighbors. When I'm outside, I'm literally there, physically available to people as they're walking by, and I've had so many good conversations. I've gotten to know so many people this way. We've shared seeds, we've shared extra beets and potatoes, we've given gardening advice, and it's been a really nice way to connect with the people on my street. It's also, there's so many metaphors there, but it's also a way that we're literally putting roots down into the soil of the land that we live on. And that feels significant, again, as a renter, that we've chosen to do that, even though we don't know how long we'll be in this home. We have a WhatsApp group with our neighbors so that we stay connected and we can communicate about things that are happening on our block. We do block parties, and we borrow things from each other and share eggs and sugar and things like that, tables, chairs for extra events and things. We provide childcare for each other sometimes, and we've just genuinely developed true friendships and connections, and there is a sense of interconnectedness on our street, which I'm so, so grateful for. And as a Christian, as a Jesus follower, I have to think that this is how it should be, that we rely on each other, that we open ourselves to conversations with people who are different than us, that we learn from one another. And I feel like our life and our kids' lives have been richer and better because of trying to live into this way of placemaking in very doable, ordinary ways.
Thank you for that. that up, and that was encouraging. I was asked to talk about my role in our local community garden, Cedar Cottage Community Garden, just located south of Trout Lake here in Vancouver. When we first moved to the new area, we had a very busy three-year-old out exploring often, and we'd always find ourselves kind of congregating in this creative, beautiful garden space, and eventually we signed up to have our own plot. My original thought, realized it was maybe a bit selfish, I was like, what can I get from this garden? We're gonna grow, spend some time with the kids there, and spend some time with elders and get that knowledge transfer, and I was kind of really excited about that. Really kind of realizing that, it was kind of a one-way stream, but pretty soon I realized how much value this garden brought to the community. And I really just wanted to get more involved and just realizing all the community benefits, and I, spent an hour talking about that, but community gardens are such an essential part for so many communities. One of the partnerships with this garden that kind of tipped me over the board to say, I just need to get involved, this is so much goodness here. There was a partnership with the local neighborhood house where we would put about, I think, anywhere from 300 to 400 pounds of fresh produce was going directly into their food programs. I'm like, this is beautiful. And just the mentality that you take care of your plot and you also spend time taking care of others' plots and neighborhood house plots. So just a beautiful mindset that really drew me in. During the pandemic, the community gardens were considered an essential place for people, and I see why now in so many ways. I'm really grateful this was considered in Vancouver. We continued our social distancing work parties, and we shared out the harvest as best we could during these times. And this garden really shifted into a sanctuary during that period, and I kind of realized now it probably is a sanctuary always for people. And the last couple of years, the garden itself, its existence is being challenged by development, which has really threatened the garden community itself. So it's kind of now leveraged us into a position of social activism, which I wasn't expecting as I joined the garden. But we've been meeting with City Council and the Parks Board and, knocking on Emily's doors. Like, I think as a collective community, we are definitely fighting for the goodness that this garden has and brings to the community. So I definitely want to encourage others to think about this and get involved with your community garden, but maybe a warning, getting a garden plot might be a gateway to social activism, so just be wary. Thank you.
Yeah, Artisan Church has been a big part of kind of feeling at home for Carrie and I over the last number of years. And this story stretches back. Some of you might have been in the community at that time, but as we came to the end of our LGBTQ plus inclusion process a number of years ago and came to the milestone statement on the third posture way, a letter was circulated among the community from someone who was a bit on the side of our community over the years, but who expressed deep opposition. And beyond opposition, made some accusations for those of us who were involved in the process, and kind of particularly around Carrie and myself, a few others, suggesting that we had caused harm to the wider community. It was a hard moment. It was really tough. It was painful. It invoked some shame, some questioning. And as we kind of sat with that letter, we went home one day, and a few people in the community had received this letter, and we got a text from Scott Anderson, who we didn't know at the time very well. And he said, hey, are you at home? What's your address? I have something I'd like to drop off. And so a few hours later, Scott came by with a warm, freshly baked loaf of sourdough that he had made. And he said to us, I just want you to know that you're part of this body. And he gave us that loaf of bread. And we walked up to our apartment, and Carrie and I just wept. I don't think that there is a gesture that could have made us feel more at home or more cared for or more welcomed. And it really has provoked in us, I think, from that time onward, just to think about what acts of simple care we can extend that demonstrate belonging and love and inclusion. And this really connects, for me, what this kind of sermon series at large has been, I guess, impressing upon me, which is just this commitment to place. And as so many of us, I think we feel the pressures of staying in Vancouver. Carrie and I have been in this, somewhat precarious place the last few years of our housing and looking beyond Vancouver, kind of always looking beyond. And I think that's so much in contradiction to what the Jeremiah passage is saying of plan to stay. But I think, yeah, a line that's really come to me over the last number of weeks as we've been going through this sermon is from an essay from D.K. Chesterton, where he's reflecting on good places. And I think that sometimes, where's the best place I can live, you know? Beyond Vancouver, is it Squamish? Is it Sunshine Coast? And he says that of the places that were kind of considered great, they people didn't love them because they were great. They were great because people loved them. And I think about that call for ourselves and that commitment to place and how love can be extended in a loaf of bread or through the acts of a community garden or all the other ways that we can express that to one another.
Ooh. Thanks so much to all three of you for sharing. And I think I heard in actually each one of yours that combination that we're talking about of ordinary life being intentionally engaged with as a way of promoting or contributing to the common good beyond oneself and the people that you love. I think another, like the next sort of step is thinking about, okay, so then what kind of common good do we want to contribute towards? And we're not going to get into that now, but I think that's a really interesting imaginative exercise of thinking, okay, if we were building the city from the ground up or the neighborhood from the ground up, what would be in it? And how? And then where are the places that we can then nurture those elements? The other thing that I'm thinking about too, in as we finish up here, is just beyond. In Canada, we're highly privileged with a fair amount of wealth, and our homemaking impacts and is impacted by global realities as well. And so next week, we're going to be thinking about that, connecting sort of placemaking here with placemaking around the world. And so I don't want to lose sight of that as well as we speak about placemaking in a very local way, as we're all connected. All right, so as we sojourn with God in our displacement, we don't long for another world. We long to dwell in this world, not to wander in it. And we long for relationships, connectedness in this world, not disembodiment. The homeland which we yearn for as sojourners is this world, redeemed and transfigured. And so we work towards that. Brian Walsh puts it this way, and I think this is the question about what is the vision for our common good becomes really important. The kingdom of God has not yet realized in its fullness, and because of that, Christian sojourners are aching visionaries who bear witness to and work for a future shalom. So as we come to the table in just a moment, let's just bring those visions. And maybe if we don't have it, let's ask for it. Let's ask for that vision for the common good as people of God in this city, in this place. And in further east and further north and west, all the places that we come from.